How do you end the Iran war? That seems to be the big question confronting US President Donald Trump this week. He's bombed Iran, he's assassinated the key leaders, but Iran is signaling that they're quite content to keep fighting and especially to wage economic war on the US. How can he finish it? How does he reconcile Israel's very different objectives and views of this war? We're going to look at the state of play on today's Trumpet World. The US and Israel seem to be developing quite different views over the Iran war. Donald Trump wants to end it, maybe not at any cost, but certainly keen to bring it to a close, whereas Israel seems more willing to continue the fighting and to finish the job. To get the latest on this potential split, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, the New York Times reported on March 24th that President Trump has sent a bulleted peace plan to the Iranians. He already has a framework on how to end the war, and he wants to get the Iranians involved in negotiations. We haven't seen, or the public hasn't seen, the text of this yet, but Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, a few days later, did confirm that a message had been sent. The best we could determine, President Trump was asking for more of what he was asking before, for Iran to dismantle its own nuclear facilities, for Iran to dismantle its own ballistic missile program, for Iran to stop funding terror groups. And Iran basically said, thank you, but no thank you. We're not interested in negotiating based on these principles. I believe one spokesman said that America was basically negotiating with itself, and that they're going to set their own terms for how the war ends, and they're going to be in it for the long haul.
Actually, on that point, I wonder if you could kind of clarify for me something I've been a bit confused on. Is I saw that news, you saw one person coming from Iran saying, is America talking to itself because we're not talking to you? And then I also saw news about Iran having a counterproposal. Obviously, if Iran has got a counterproposal, then they are talking. So are we getting contradictory messages from the Iranian government? Are we getting different messages from different parts of the government? Like, what's behind the contradictory response from Iran?
Well, a lot of it may just very well be smoke screens popped up. If they want to have the strongest negotiating position possible, then they don't want... It would be bad on their part to suggest that they need a deal. I think they want to show themselves as the party of, we don't need a deal, we're perfectly happy going...
Right, but I mean, if one part of the government is saying, we're not talking to you, and another part is saying, we are talking to you, here's our proposal, we reject what you've sent us... What's the story there?
Well, also, you have to remember the Iranian government has been gutted of their top leadership, and all of these different departments aren't necessarily coordinating with each other. Even the IRGC itself, there's a lot of discussion as to how much of their actions are coming from the top down, and it's just local commanders saying, well, as of this day, I don't have a boss anymore. I'm just going to do whatever I want with the men under me.
So do we know that Donald Trump, the people that he's talking to, have the ability to enforce or to even stick to a ceasefire if one is negotiated?
Exactly. The best we could determine is that the main person Trump is speaking to, or rather his representatives are speaking to, is the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, who is a former general who has connections with the IRGC, but he doesn't necessarily speak on behalf of the whole organization. Both Western observers and probably a lot of people in Iran itself are wondering basically the same question. If I want to call Iran, who do I call? They technically have a supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, who we've spoken of before, but his state of health is in question, and how much he's able to actually carry out direct orders is also in question. So this very well may be a circumstance of, you have a general glue holding the country together, which would be the IRGC, setting general policy, but there may not necessarily be a clear chain of command with the various organs and arms of the state on who has the authority to say what, who has the authority to make a deal or not make a deal or tell everybody else to stand down. And even with these circumstances in and of themselves, with everybody gutted, with the state of the Supreme Leader being in question, if I wouldn't be surprised if there were a lot of commanders in the IRGC sensing smelling blood in the water and deciding this is my opportunity to shake things up a little bit and not even and setting themselves up maybe for future power positions this way.
So Donald Trump talking to Israel, J.D. Vance, or to Iran, sorry, I think J.D. Vance heading to Pakistan, trying to work on a deal. What's the Israeli perspective on this?
Well, the day after the Times published that original piece, they published another exclusive. They're obviously dependent on anonymous sources from a handful of papers, so perhaps some of these things we can take with a grain of salt, but they claim that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has set a 48-hour deadline earlier this week to target as many different assets of the Iranian government as possible, in the worry that President Trump could pull the rug from under their feet, declare a premature victory without consulting them, and basically just do a fire sale to cut their losses and go back without necessarily informing the Israelis. On Monday, I think this was very telling. The Israeli government press conference sent out a handful of statements from Prime Minister Netanyahu, including, quote, President Trump believes there is an opportunity to leverage the tremendous achievements we have reached alongside the U.S. military to realize the goals of the war through an agreement that will safeguard our vital interests, end quote. Now, I don't dispute the authenticity of that statement in the sense that I'm sure that's what President Trump believes. Netanyahu didn't say that's what he believed. For his entire political career in decades, he has constantly spoken out not just on bad deals, quote-unquote, with Iran, but any deal with Iran. He and many in Israel rightly see Iran as and the regime that's currently ruling there as an existential threat to Israel's security. So the fact that he's sending out positively spun statements like this suggests that that there is peace talks coming forward, that he doesn't really have a say in the matter, and he's trying to make the optics with his relations with the U.S., as well as preparing the Israeli public going forward as least bad as possible.
So we focus, obviously, on the news that the Bible shows us is important, and we use Bible prophecy as our guide, even not just on how we analyze the news, but what we focus on this show. Obviously, the Iran war is a huge deal. And what are the prophetic implications of what you've just discussed, both with America's approach to ending this war, but then also that relationship with Israel?
Well, we've spoken before on this program, on this very subject, about how if you look at Bible prophecy, you look at Daniel 11, our go-to prophecy about Iran, which speaks of an end-time king of the south provoking a world war. Mr. Gerald Fleury, your editor-in-chief, has written in his book, The King of the South, that this is referring to Iran and its Islamist allies poking at Europe. And he goes into more detail in the book, but he mentions that if you look at all the different prophetic players in there, America's not involved. That suggests that their time of being the big mover and shaker in the Middle East is long gone. This war is by far the largest operation the United States has done in the Middle East in years. And it's only weeks old at this point. Already we're seeing a lot of buyer's remorse from Washington, from the government, but especially from the people on the ground. It's pretty clear that America is realizing they can't do what they did before, and they're trying to find an off-ramp to that. Regarding its relations with Israel, the two prophecies that came to my mind were in Isaiah 9:21 and Zechariah 11:14, which speaks of the brotherhood between Judah and Israel being broken. And for those that may not necessarily be aware, as Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of our predecessor, wrote in The United States and Britain in Prophecy, another free book we offer, Israel prophetically is referring to, among other countries, the United States. And that one of the curses for disobedience, from the people of Israel to against God and God's law would be that God would break the brotherhood between the different tribes, between the different nations that descend from Israel. We saw a lot of that under former President Barack Obama and Joe Biden. Some of that was repaired under President Trump, but we're seeing a lot of irreconcilable differences when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to military between these two countries. And when push comes to shove, we saw tremendous unity between these two when the war started, but how this war ends could end up rupturing Israel and America's relationship to a worse level than what before the war happened. And it's important also to remember that this war is changing daily. There are reports that President Trump is sending 10,000 new troops to the Middle East. He seems to change his own goalposts on every half day on what his war aims are. So the situation could dramatically escalate even in Iran before this episode comes out. But these are the main prophetic trends we are watching for. And even without following the play-by-play, the broad outline is showing these are coming to pass.
And it still seems like there's more to develop on that story, on that prophetic story of that divide between Britain and, or from the United States and Israel. We're not there yet. And I think even with the events of this week, we're still quite a ways from there. You would expect Donald Trump and Israel to be able to continue to work together for quite some time. But it is a picture of what's coming. And I think given some of the, especially, you know, in Israel, if they're in this position where as well, they look at the United States, they see how much the Democratic Party has turned against them. And they're seeing more and more of the fringe on MAGA, you know, the Tucker Carlsons turn against them. You know, they'd have to be hedging their bets and looking for, well, are there any other powers that can help us? And that is where Europe enters the picture. Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. One of the big reasons why the United States wants to end this war, Donald Trump does want to find a way to wrap up this war, is the success that Iran has been having in targeting America's economy and the global economy. We've talked before on this show about the economic fallout from this, but the longer this war drags on, the bigger that fallout is, and the more we see of Iran's strategy here of economic warfare. So to get the latest on this, we'll go to our Anglo-America correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that's... Yes, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps pretty much has de facto control over the Strait of Hormuz currently. And they haven't shut down flow through it completely. They're actually still letting boats pass as long as those boats pay a toll in Chinese yuan and are en route to a destination where they're going to be selling cargo or oil in Chinese yuan or at least some other currency other than dollars. So it really looks like they're not only disrupting the world economy by drastically lowering the flow of oil through the world's number one energy choke point, but deliberately targeting the U.S. dollar. And so this is a huge reason why, like President Trump, he's talking about the importance of opening the Strait of Hormuz. He earlier this week, he actually gave Iran a 48-hour deadline to open the Strait before he started bombing stuff. Now, just last minute, I think late yesterday, he came out and he said that he's making good progress in negotiations with the Iranians. So he's extending that deadline another 5 days. And that Iran, when they do eventually decide to open up the Strait of Hormuz, wants to act as the toll keeper. Basically keep this policy in place where they're still only, where the oil going in and out of Hormuz is traded in Chinese yuan, which is a big deal. It's actually gotten the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. He's pushing President Trump pretty hard to take control of the Strait of Hormuz and then to press on towards full regime change in Tehran and remake the Middle East. So we're now in a very strange situation where, like, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and the Prime Minister of Israel more or less agree with each other that there needs to be regime change in Iran and are pushing the Americans, who are the more reluctant ones. Usually Israel and the Arabians don't get along well, but on this issue, they do seem to have at least a temporary convergence in foreign policy. And this is a huge thing for American economic security as well. The dollar, as was when it was established by the Founding Fathers under the Constitution, was actually backed by both silver and gold. For about the first 100 years of American history, the dollar was backed by gold and silver, therefore gold and silver had a convertible ratio to each other. After World War I, they switched it over, they dropped the silver part and just stayed on the gold standard. And then in 1971, Richard Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard. So you'll commonly hear people say, I have a lot of friends who say this, and they're only half right, that, well, the dollar used to be backed by gold, but now it's not backed by anything. Although it's kind of backed by oil. When Nixon took us off the gold standard, he made a deal with the Saudi Arabians. And under, like, an informal deal. It's not a formal congressionally ratified treaty, but it's like a deal between the heads of the two nations that the U.S. military would defend the Gulf states and keep the oil flowing through Hormuz. And in return, Saudi Arabia would not only buy U.S. Treasury bonds themselves, but they'd pressure the rest of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, to buy oil in dollars. So the way it works is the world's major oil exporters in the Organization of Oil Exporting Countries, they buy oil in dollars. Therefore, banks that want to buy oil need dollars. Therefore, they buy treasury bonds to keep dollars in stash. And the dollar becomes the world reserve currency. And since the demand for it's high, even though it's not backed by pegged to gold like it used to be, the currency stays stable. And so a ton of the dollar's reserve currency status is actually linked back to this informal deal we've had with Saudi Arabia for almost 60 years now, where we defend Hormuz and they buy dollars. Now you're actually having a number of people like who are openly wondering, and we'll still don't know what President Trump's going to do, but it's like, is the United States still committed to defending Hormuz? Or is Iran going to actually follow through with its threat, seize control of it, act as the toll keeper, and start demanding payment in yuan or some other currency? Because if that happens, the Saudi Arabians, they have no reason to upkeep their end of the deal. And that could be a huge blow, maybe even the death blow, to the dollar's reserve currency status.
So how much of this is chicken and egg? Like, how much of it is oil is denominated in dollars because the dollar is the world's reserve currency versus the dollar is the world's currency because oil is generally sold for dollars?
That is a good point, because it's, like I said, after World War II, America had accumulated most of the world's gold reserves. And so the dollar kind of became the world currency because it was pegged to gold. Then as soon as we took it off the gold standard, Nixon made this deal with the Saudi Arabians, which was a pretty easy deal to make because the dollar was already the world's reserve currency. And so now you are actually getting into a situation where it's been going on so long that like even if the United States reneged on their side of the deal, refused to defend the Strait of Hormuz, And the Iranians said that now you can only sell oil in yuan. There would probably still be many nations who aren't as closely aligned with China who bought oil from other places in dollars just out of sheer force of habit because the dollar has been the reserve currency so long. I think that would be the one aspect why it might not be the death knell, but it would definitely be a huge blow to it. One interesting thing, I was thinking about this story just from a prophetic angle, is we've got two separate prophecies we're watching that might not be related, but then again, maybe they will be. One is there's this, we're looking for prophetically for the dollar to lose its reserve currency status. One of the curses in Leviticus 26 is that if a nation disobeys God's law, if America disobeys God's law, other nations will lend to it and it won't lend to others. And so if you're lending, if other people are lending to you and you're not lending to them, you have a national debt. So the national debt is prophesied. And if the national debt gets too big, the currency is unstable and it loses its reserve currency status. The late Herbert W. Armstrong even did a personal prophecy, which is saying that because this debt is prophesied, he felt that like the collapse of the U.S. economy would be the trigger to get 10 nations in Europe to unite into a superpower. And we call that a personal prophecy because the national debt is prophesied in Leviticus 26, and the 10 nations in Europe uniting is prophesied in Revelation 17. There's a little bit of conjecture into the one leading to the other, but it definitely looks like things are moving in that direction. But then there's another prophecy we're watching here in Psalms 83 about this group of Arab nations, primarily nations descended from Edom and Ishmael, allying with Assyria or end time Germany. So like these Arab Gulf states, the Psalms 83 is they're actually allying with the European Union. So we're looking for the dollar to lose its reserve currency status based off Leviticus 26. And we're looking for these Arab Gulf states to ally with Germany based on Psalms 83. The United States government for about 60 years has had an informal deal where we prop up the dollar as the reserve currency by defending these Arab Gulf states. So if the United States doesn't seem committed to defending the Strait of Hormuz or upkeeping this alliance with the Saudi Arabians, the question you have to ask yourself is like, well, is that going to be one of the reasons that these Arab Gulf states start looking more to Europe to form a strong alliance? Again, that's not necessarily direct from the Bible that like, the Arabs are going to form an alliance with Germany because they don't trust America to defend Hormuz. But it is prophesied that they'll form an alliance with Germany, and it is prophesied that America is going to lose its reserve currency status. So it does make sense that that may be one of the reasons that these Arab states start developing something like a petro-euro, where you're like, okay, well, we'll buy euro bonds same as we used to buy dollar bonds if Europe's ready to defend the Strait of Hormuz. I saw a news story just before I came in here that France doesn't want to get involved in the U.S. war with Iran, but they have reached out already to 35 other militaries around the world trying to build a coalition to defend Hormuz after the war is over. So I think Europe's definitely already taking this showdown over Hormuz as a wake-up call that they need their own military alliance ready to defend that. And the Saudis have definitely seemed like they're willing to buy treasury bonds from anyone who's willing to guarantee the safety and security of the Strait of Hormuz because They're a petrostate. 30% of their GDP comes from oil sales. Some of it goes through the Red Sea. Most of it goes through the Persian Gulf. So it's like their economy can't function if the Strait of Hormuz is closed. And so they've proven themselves very willing in the past to buy our treasury bonds because we buy the Strait of Hormuz. And they may be willing to make that deal with another superpower if America's not ready to step up to the plate here.
Yeah, that's a really good, important point. And we'll certainly be watching for what Europe does and how they move into the region. I mean, it is a really interesting to see this. We don't want to help America, but we'll help Cyprus. We'll move in there. We'll find ways to kind of plan to get more involved afterwards. So, just an important story. So thank you for that. We just very interesting to see how all of these negotiations about that peace deal ends. Well, kind of, we are a few weeks out now from the Iran war. That are other bits of news. We'll get into some of that as we talk about Asia, as we talk about Europe. But what else do you have for us from the United States?
Another big story in the United States this week is I haven't been to an airport recently, but I'm glad I don't have any big trips planned because the lines at the airport are insane. And the reason for that is ever since the anti-ICE protest in Minneapolis, the Democrats have refused to pass a bill funding the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security runs Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement, which does more than just deport illegal immigrants. They also run the TSA, Transportation Security Authority, that are making sure there's running the metal detectors and other things at airport lines. So those employees aren't getting paid. They've asked them to keep coming to work, although many of them haven't, because why go to work if you're not going to get paid for it? So there's a huge shortage of TSA employees making enormous lines. As the government, like the Democrats are basically holding airports to hostage right now until they get ICE defunded. It looks like that the House of Representatives passed a bill this morning funding the TSA and the rest of the Department of Homeland Security except ICE. They said the Democrats and Republicans, they'll keep fighting over ICE, but they've passed a temporary bill to defend the rest of it. Now, that bill hasn't gone through the Senate yet. It'll probably go through the Senate later today. I don't know what the Senate's going to decide on that bill or if Donald Trump's even going to sign it. President Trump, he has promised that he will not sign this bill or any other bill, any piece of legislation, period, until Congress passes the Save America Act, which mandates proof of citizenship to vote. So I don't know if he's going to back down on that. I think the latest news is he's had his lawyers like look through it. And he's seen that the Department of Homeland Security does have some savings, money that Congress gave them in the past that they haven't spent yet. So he signed an executive order this morning saying, we'll use that savings to pay the TSA employees to get the airports working while we continue this fight with the Democrats over ICE. So another story we're watching closely, again, hearkening back to Leviticus 26, there's talk about another one of the curse in the nations, other than the national debt, is an open border, like the fact that your high and fenced walls will come down. The foreigner amongst you will get up very high and you will get down very low. So we're definitely seeing that where the Biden administration let 10 million illegal immigrants into America. There were probably 20 million here already before that. So it's probably now at least 30 million illegal immigrants in America. The Democrats are doing everything they can to make sure these people don't get deported. Right now, they're basically holding airport lines to hostage so that Republicans cave and don't force this. So it looks like President Trump, he may have a couple things he can do with executive orders to just drag this out a little longer. But yeah, this is one of these stories that it's not going to be the last time you hear me talk about it on Trump World. And then two other quick stories. Another one just showing the continuing curse that natural disasters can have on the U.S. economy while all these other geopolitical disasters are going on. There's been some back-to-back floods in Hawaii that have prompted the state to evacuate something like 5,000 people. I think like first responders had to come and evacuate 233. The rest of them just had to leave their homes temporarily of their own volition. No one's died yet that I've heard about the governor of Hawaii saying that the damage to property will cost about $1 billion. So that just highlights another economic curse that God can send on a nation through weather disasters, a type of curse that like the nation can normally absorb in good times, but at times when the Straits of Hormuz is closed and you've got all sorts of other economic turmoil, is definitely just making things worse. And then not to make the Anglo-America section completely about America all the time, only 90% of the time. We also have a pretty big deal this week between Australia and Germany, a defense agreement focusing mainly on cooperation with military satellites. That's another trend we watch here. There's prophecies in Ezekiel about the lovers of the English-speaking nations betraying them, showing that right now, like I said, the Western world, we're in a huge conflict with Iran, we're in a conflict with Russia, we're in conflicts with China. We have many open enemies. The one nation that actually is really a enemy to the English-speaking world, even though they don't know it, is Germany, which is why the Bible uses this lover language. It's not like a foreign enemy is just going to come against you and you should have saw it coming. It's a nation you trusted that betrays you. And so when you see deals like this with Australia forming military alliances with Germany, where you're now cooperating on defense satellites that are hugely important to their defense, it just does show how devastating a German double cross could be. Because they're a nation that's already kind of like in the know with a lot of our defense strategy and defense secrets.
Another part of that, because you're right, there was the Germany-Australia deal this week. There was also the EU signed a big trade deal that they've been working with Australia for a while. And this is huge for Europe's access to raw materials. Like Australia has a huge amount. It's produce about half the world's lithium, according to Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Writing on this, they said that the deal would meet about 2/3 of the EU's raw material needs. Now, I'm not sure exactly how broadly they were defining raw materials, but that's pretty huge for the EU to get access to a lot of that raw material. They've been struggling for raw materials since the war with Russia, or since Russia invaded Ukraine, and they've been sanctioning Russia. So that's a pretty big shot in the arm for Europe, coming courtesy of Australia. And exactly as you say, the EU is going to turn and betray these Israelite powers, Australia included. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Now, a lot of the commentary around the Iran war is also focused on what's its effect on Russia, what is its effect on China? And there's been a couple of schools of thought here. You've had some saying that, well, this war is a big blow to China. Asia gets a lot of its resources, a lot of its oil and gas via the Strait of Hormuz. China has, of course, been a supporter of Iran in the past. This is pretty bad for them. Others have pushed back and saying, well, actually, America is using up many of the weapons that it would have to use to defend Taiwan. It's pulling resources out of Asia to be involved in the Middle East. It's pulling missile interception facilities, equipment from South Korea. It's pulling its amphibious forces and its navy out of the Pacific and into the Persian Gulf, that in a lot of ways this could benefit China. Now, at the same time that there's a lot of this discussion going on, though, there are some significant events underway in China. We've had China has been purging some of its military officials, and we'll look at the results of some of those purges with our Asia correspondent Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. There have been drastic military purges in the last few years, and there was a really insightful analysis in The Diplomat this week arguing that these purges are weakening China's military preparedness to a considerable degree, and they may prove deleterious to Xi Jinping's global ambitions. This was a piece published on Wednesday, just very insightful, and it starts off examining just the scale of these purges. And there have been more than 100 high-ranking officials in the People's Liberation Army that have been either dismissed or have disappeared or died under unclear circumstances, and that's just since 2022. So quite an extraordinary number. And the most recent of these purges were probably the most consequential. This was in January when we saw Xi Jinping get rid of Zhang Youxia, who was second in command of the People's Liberation Army, or the PLA. And at the same time, she also got rid of Chief of Joint Staff General Liu Jinli. So two extremely powerful men, and with their ouster, China's Central Military Commission was left with only two of its seven members in place. And one of those was Xi Jinping himself, and the other one was a general who was not as powerful as the other. So all of these purges of the top brass, the very highest echelon in the military, have been just extremely drastic. And Xi Jinping always portrays them as being anti-corruption measures. You know, he portrays this as a war against corruption. But analysts understand that he's mostly just removing any threats to his personal power. That's clear from the way he replaces these seasoned generals, these men with, you know, the stature and the networks to potentially challenge him, with men who are very much lacking in experience, but who are fiercely devoted to what you could call the Xi Jinping cult of personality. So the experienced generals get the axe, and the yes men get hired. And it does seem to be successful in securing Xi Jinping's position at the helm of China, but the trouble is that it has hollowed out military's command structure, and it has left numerous key posts in the hands of untested officials whose chief, you know, qualification really is sycophancy, and these men whose capacity to actually lead is deeply in doubt. I'll just read a little bit here from The Diplomat's analysis. It says, Xi's purges might create strategic deficiencies by depriving the PLA of much-needed operational experience and expertise. With the removal of the battle-hardened Zhang Youxia and Liu Jinli, as well as their followers, informational and institutional memory in the Chinese military system could gradually diminish. That could pose an obstacle to the PLA's goal of becoming a world-class military by mid-century. End quote. And then from there, this article goes on to explain that in a deeply personalistic system, like the one that Xi Jinping is building, leaders often get stuck in kind of an information trap. You know, when they surround themselves only with yes men who give them only good news, that might build up a leader's confidence and his sense of success in the short term, but it means that he'll be blind to inconvenient truths, the kinds of truths that must be confronted if a nation really is to assert durable dominance over its region. So it all means that even as Xi Jinping tightens his grip on power, the nation that he is leading is becoming less cohesive and less prepared for war. And this is something that the Trumpet takes a very keen interest in, because we've been anticipating a reduction in the power of China and Xi Jinping relative to the power of Russia and Vladimir Putin. And that is because of Bible prophecy. Prophecy warns of a massive Asian military alliance that would arise in the modern era. It's a force that Revelation 16 calls the kings of the East. And if you look at a passage in Ezekiel 38, it gives a lot of very specific information about who the leader of this kings of the East alliance will be. And it calls him the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Meshach and Tubal are early names corresponding to modern Russian cities, and Rosh is a variation of an ancient name for Russia itself. So this man who is going to be the leader of this Asian alliance is clearly a Russian. Some language in Ezekiel 38 also shows that China will be a major part of this alliance, but the phrasing makes clear that it will not be a Chinese individual who is leading it, but a Russian will be the main king of the kings of the East. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has a booklet all about this Asian alliance and how it will be led by Vladimir Putin. And right now, this might be kind of tough for some Asia watchers to believe because China has, you know, 10 times the population of Russia, has 10 times the economic heft of Russia, and even a more powerful military than Russia if you exclude nuclear weapons from the calculus there. So right now it could be tough for some to see how China will end up being the junior partner in the Russia-China tandem. But when you look at these purges that are happening in China's military, and you see how much it's really weakening China's military preparedness, and then at the same time you factor in the fact that China right now is facing serious headwinds in both economics and demographics, all of these factors could very quickly reduce the power of Xi Jinping and China relative to Vladimir Putin and Russia, and it could shift the whole power balance in accordance with prophecy. So if anyone would like to understand the details of this up-and-coming Kings of the East alliance and the impending reduction of Chinese power relative to Russian power, I hope that you'll order a copy of that booklet by Mr. Fleury. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. My perception, accurate or not, of the kind of the modern Chinese Communist Party is that they're a relatively pragmatic bunch, that they want to retain power. They're not necessarily wedded to sticking to every jot and tittle of the Communist Manifesto or of Karl Marx. They'll compromise on certain things. And in particular, they have tried to learn from some of the mistakes of the Soviet Union. And indeed, we saw where China has been able to engage in things like international trade without the downfall of the communist system, something that the Soviet Union never managed to do. This was a very well-known mistake of the Soviet Union. You know, the fact that Stalin had sent most of his top generals to the gulags was a major part in the reason why they did so badly in their war against Finland, why they really struggled at the opening of World War II. We know that China has designs on taking Taiwan. You know, they have plans, prospects of war in their future. They know the history. They've generally shown themselves to not be stupid, to kind of learn these lessons. So why do you think they're repeating this? Like, are there other pressures, I guess, is what I'm getting at, that they know that there's a problem here, but they're kind of being forced in this direction anyway, even though that this appears to be the lesser of the evils of what's confronting them? Or do you think maybe Xi Jinping, it's just kind of, he's gotten to the point now where he's not even entirely rational in his pursuit of power?
I think it veers toward the latter that you just said there. I believe that Xi Jinping is so concerned about his personal power that he's making a series of decisions that are good for him in the short term, but bad for China in the long term. And it's strictly out of self-preservation. He views some of these other men at the upper echelons in the Chinese Communist Party as perhaps corrupt. In his view, corruption could mean not fiercely loyal to him personally. And so he wants to get rid of them, even though he knows that this leaves some, you know, gaping voids in the military command. But it's just he feels that he has to do it or else he may be threatened.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. What else do you have for us from Asia this week?
Yes, just one other quick story here about Russia. Its war on Ukraine, of course, rages on, even though it's not getting nearly the attention that it once did, being overshadowed by the Iran war. But this week, Russia fired almost 1,000 drones and missiles at Ukraine in less than 24 hours. This was on the night of March 22nd and into the morning of March 24th. And this sets a new record, marking Russia's largest aerial attack of the whole war, which is now in its fifth year. And Ukraine was able to shoot down most of the drones and missiles, but many of them were able to evade the defenses and strike targets all across Ukraine, mostly civilian targets in various population centers. So we have been seeing kind of a fresh wave of optimism out there that people are saying Russia's finally really getting worn down and getting close to depleting its firepower. But this new attack, the largest of its kind of the whole war, shows that a lot of that optimism is misplaced. Russia still has obscene amounts of weaponry and, of course, no compunctions at all about using it as ruthlessly as possible to achieve its expansionist ambitions.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, on to conclude with a story I find absolutely fascinating from Europe, and that is that Volkswagen said this week, or the Financial Times reported, that they're in talks with Israel's Rafael Advanced Defense System to convert one of their car parts to making Iron Dome parts. Pretty interesting story. This is a company that their factories helped make the V1 flying bomber during World War II, and now they might be returning from making VW Beetles and hippie vans, whatever the proper name of that is, and instead making Iron Dome missile defense systems. It's part of this trend that we've seen again and again in Germany, where the car companies are struggling, so they're looking at retooling. So their particular plant in Osnabrück, it employs 2,300 workers, and it's basically facing closure after VW ends production of one of their cars in 2027. This would save their jobs, and it would make the kind of heavy-duty transportation trucks, the electricity generators, some of these things for these interceptor missiles. The missiles themselves would still be built in Germany. They'd build a separate Rafael facility in Germany to do that. And the Financial Times said it would take comparatively little investment. They'd get going in about 12 to 18 months. And Germany would then become a hub for the Iron Dome and be sold all over Europe. And so many prophetic implications of this. You're getting Germany embracing the military side of things, its economy retooling around the military. Then you have Israel trusting in Germany, like we were talking about with Mihailo right at the beginning, that you've got passages like Ezekiel 23 that talk about Israel treating Assyria as lovers. And in prophetic language, this is the nations of Israel referring to the Jews and others. And then Assyria is modern day Germany. They're turning to them as lovers. They're looking to these allies for protection instead of God. And so here they're handing over the crown jewel of their air defense system to Germany. And as they're doing this, they're praising the enduring strength of the Berlin-Jerusalem alliance. And then Germany is becoming this hub for that technology all across Europe. Israel thinks it's drawing close to Germany as a powerful protector, and it's giving gifts like it talks about in Isaiah chapter 23. And it's a catastrophic mistake. They're building up the power that is actually planning to destroy them. Now, you can a great place to go, or I'd really like to encourage you to look at Mr. Stephen Flurry's Trumpet Daily Show. He had the show all about this a couple of days ago. Germany will take any excuse to rearm. That aired on March 25th. You can find that on YouTube, on Rumble, on our website. He combined that story with also comments from the German president, where he was very critical of what Donald Trump has been doing with Iran. He condemned it as breaking international law. He said the rift is too deep and trust in American power politics has been lost, not only among our allies, but worldwide. And he talked about how, whatever happens, well, Germany's turning against America and they're looking for any excuse to rearm. An important story to see and to watch there coming out of Germany. That is about all we have time for on today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to all of our guests. Thank you as well to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. Even as we speak now, and as I wrap up, Mihailo Zekic is off conducting a special interview to be aired next week, looking at the rising dictatorships, you could say, or Eastern Europe slide in a very dictatorial direction. So we should have that for you, barring any other big unforeseen events on Wednesday. Please do tune into that. And until then, keep watching your world.